Hello and welcome to the Comicast. I'm Liam. Craig is away. On today's show, I talk to Sean Michael Wilson, who is a comic book writer originally from Edinburgh in Scotland, but moved to Japan. He's edited the groundbreaking Axe alternative manga for Top Shelf. He's done some comics with Classical Comics, and he's done tons of manga. I started off by asking him how an Edinburgh lad got all the way to Japan.
Well, what I normally say, when people normally say, how did you get to Japan? And my normal joke reply is, on a plane. But if they ask it, oh, I say, have you meant why? No. The thing is, the question really in a way is, why is there not more people here, you know, from not just Britain or Ireland, from France and America and Germany and all over? Because there's so many manga fans, and for a lot of them, it's a dream to come over here to Japan and work in the manga industry.
Yeah.
The question, in a way, is why is there not hundreds? Because when I got over here, I realized about a year later that I was the only one here. I'm the only, not just the only Scottish guy. I'm the only British guy, the only Irish guy, whatever, in the whole, you know, that whole area. There's only me in terms of, like, doing professional, you know, professional level.
Yeah.
There's a couple of, there's three American guys now, or two American guys and one guy who's, like, Argentinian, stroke American, stroke Jamaican or something. I wasn't saying that in a way to slag him off. He's a good lad and he's a talented artist. Felipe is his name. And then there's Lars, who's from Minneapolis in America, and Adam, and he's from California, I think, in America. So they're here, and there's a few Koreans and there's a few Chinese. There was even a Swedish lady for a while. But no one else from like our part of the world, you know.
So do you all stick together then? Is it a kind of close knit community of people not originally from Japan?
Well, yes, but only over the internet, so to speak, because
right.
We're all in different places, you know, right. In Japan. So
okay.
It's not like they hang out. Well, there is a group in Nagoya. Nagoya is like a big city south of Tokyo. It's like it's bigger than the whole island, actually. I mean, the population.
Right.
there's a group of them there hang out, but no, mostly it's over the internet. But we have like collaborated over a few interesting projects, like you remember the Tohoku tsunami and earthquake disaster earlier this year, right? So there's been two charity books that have been organized. One from a bunch in Britain, and then an American guy, Adam, that I just mentioned, in Nagoya, he organized a charity book called Aftershock.
Oh, yes,
and, yeah. So me and Lars and him and a bunch of other ones are in that. So, yeah, we've done some things together as a team, and we're planning to try and do more because it's such an unusual thing. It's a good selling point, you know, marketing wise.
And how did you had you been doing comics in Scotland?
My first book came out from funded by the Arts Council London, actually.
Okay.
I don't know, I think I must have like forgotten to mention that I was Scottish to them or something. So I shouldn't say that. They'll ask for the money back. Say, hey, wait a minute, pal. I was living in London at the time, so it's fair enough. And they gave me this grant. Well, that's how my comic book career started. I put off a grant application expecting that I was going to get like a few hundred pounds. And then they sent back a successful letter, and it was like for several thousand pounds.
Wow.
And I was like, Jesus Christ, how did that happen? I was really shocked because I'd never heard of such a thing before. I think it must have been some guy who was on his last day, you know, and the council just bugger it. Give this guy lots of money. Because I've never heard of that before. I've never heard of it since. Because at that point and still now, the comic books, as you know, still don't have like a reputation as being high culture.
Yeah, it does strike me as very odd.
It is. I don't know. I still don't know to this day how it happened, but, you know, I took the money and ran. And and so what I did was I published my first book, Angel of the Woods, and that was that would be 8 years ago next month, December 2003. That's 8 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
8 years. getting a calculator. You can tell that I failed arithmetic in school.
Was that your actual first comic? Like, had you written any other kind of small press comics or?
Yeah, I had. I'd done a few small things before that, but not much really, just a couple of things. So I was lucky. So I put that book out myself and got it professionally printed and distributed by Diamond. It was published, it was printed by the company that do most independent printing in Canada, right? They're called the Quebecer Le Bon Fond or something. It's a French Canadian word I can't pronounce. So the whole thing was like, you know, professionally printed and distributed, and I got a designer in to help me. And so it was thanks to that Arts Council grant. And I've just gone from strength to strength since then. From that lucky beginning.
And how does how does someone break into the Japanese market in terms of, like, how did you go about becoming a writer, an established writer, you know, in Japan?
Well, this is the weird thing. In a way, as I said, there should be more people over trying to do that, but in a way it's very easy, and in a way it's very difficult. The thing is, when I decided to go up to, because I live in the south, you know, like, I live like in the equivalent of Cork, you might say. So actually, that's not a bad equivalent. I just did that as a joke, but come to think of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
a local centre,
right,
which is actually quite a small place, really, but it's local and dominates the area in the southwest. So Cork's a good comparison.
Yeah.
So I nip up to Tokyo quite often. So the first time I went up there, I thought, okay, let me just try and knock on doors and see what happens. So I went up with some of the artists I was working with at that time. I'm still working with them, like Akiko Shimojima. And we just said, well, let's just phone up the editors from these various publishers and go and see them. Or just first of all say, well, will they see us? And you can tell them that there's this gaijin. You know gaijin? Gaijin,
yeah.
Is foreigner. So I might slip into Japanese sometime, sorry.
Yeah, no, do.
gaijin means foreigner. And so tell them that there's this foreign comic book creator guy and he wants to meet you. And all the editors said yes. So it wasn't like a difficult thing. Maybe they were intrigued that there was this actual guide and writer turning up at their office, which must be a rare phenomenon for them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And but then, of course, these things are never that easy. Most of the time, they weren't interested in what I had to offer, or they just gave me good advice as to what might be better and come back later when you've done this and that. But I managed to, from just trying hard, get three successes. The first one was to get my stuff on the Keitai, that's the mobile phone system in Japan. And I think I'm the only British guy. I don't mind calling myself British, you know, like some Scottish people, especially if you're from an Irish background like me.
Right.
They don't like to say you're British.
Yes.
Right? I don't mind. You know, I'm okay, Scottish or British. As long as they don't say I'm English, I don't mind. So, I totally lost my track now. What was I saying?
Yes.
About the Keitai, sorry.
Yeah.
I think I'm the only British guy who's got his manga on Japanese Keitai. Or at least I'm the only one that's made a direct connection with the company anyway. And then, of course, the main success I had was with Kodansha, who we're of course the biggest publisher in Japan and therefore presumably in the world. Well, it must be one of the biggest anyway.
Absolutely.
And then in a funny twist of fate, I also got a deal with pretty much the smallest publisher in Japan. Seren Kogesha is the publisher of Axe, that is probably my most successful book so far. And I went to see both of them on the same day. And of course, Kodansha is this huge corporation who have got like, I think it's 24 stories high, their like office block. And it's a big spaceship looking thing in the middle of Tokyo. And you have to get a security badge to get in and all this kind of stuff. Right? So I went to see them in the morning. And then in the afternoon, I'm hunting around the back alleys of Shinjuku, right, this area in Tokyo, where the three-room office of Seren Kogesha is just like above a grocery store or something. So I went to see those two things in the same day. It's a big difference. And ended up working for both of them.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, well, it makes that sound easy, but I mean, there was lots of companies that weren't interested.
Yeah.
You know?
And you were talking about there about the mobile network. Are comics are they big on like phones over there in Japan?
Yeah, it's a big deal. I forgot what the latest figures was. I just saw them a few days ago, but it was certainly like something like $700 million worth of downloads.
That's
something in the range of that.
That's mad because it seems like. You know, the likes of Motion Comics and that over here, they haven't taken off hugely, you know, in a huge way yet.
No, they haven't. I mean, people have been trying and it's always threatening to take off. But then you look back and you realize it's already been 2 or 3 years gone by since that and nothing much has happened. But still, I think that is the future probably.
Yeah.
And I want to get more of my books out digitally. I think Axe is going to come out as a digital version sometime early next year. And my Story of Lee with MBM Publishing in New York, I think that one's coming out this month on a, what's it called? Comixology.
Yeah, yeah.
So my Story of Lee book should be available there on Comixology next month.
What was, how did Axe come about? I mean, it was published by Top Shelf and it's, a hugely successful collection.
Yeah, it has been. It's one of those things where, like, if you were to write down on a piece of paper what you'd want to happen, right, and then that exact thing happens, it's great. That doesn't happen much in life, you know.
Yeah.
But me and Asakawa, that's the name of the Japanese edition of Axe, who's in the Seren Kogesha publisher that I was just talking about. They're a very good publisher. I mean, I was slightly downgrading them, they're saying that they're in this wee back alleyway in Shinjuku, but they're an excellent publisher who do all their books are independent and artistic style manga, and I'm very happy to work with them, and I'm very lucky. And his attitude, well, not just his attitude, but the whole attitude of Axe, if you look at the Japanese Axe and check the English version too, it says on it that manga should be independent, manga should be open, and manga should be experimental, right? That's the motto of Axe. That's there on every Japanese edition and on our English one too. And when I saw that, I thought, that's great. That's the kind of thing that I can support, that I'm interested in. Because I've always been interested in more experimental and independent style comic books, like from the British stuff. Like, have you ever seen a magazine called Escape that was out in the 80s?
No, I can't say I have.
You've maybe heard of Paul. I was calling Paul Gravatt, but actually his name is Paul
Yes, yeah.
Sorry, Paul. Yeah. I've known him for years and I still can't pronounce his name. So it was a magazine that he had in the 80s, and I think from 83 to 92, maybe, I forget. But anyway, a good long while. And when I read that, like when I was a teenager, that really influenced me with the kind of French and British independent style stuff. So when I came to Japan and I was chatting with Asakawa-san, that's the guy's name, I immediately thought, oh, this is like a kind of Japanese version of Escape. So I was into it straight away. And so him and I hatched a plan together that we would try to get acts out in English. Because up until that point, there'd been almost nothing out in English of that type.
Yeah.
A couple of things, but very, very little. And so we came up with this wee plan, and I went to the New York Comic Book Convention in 2008, and I started showing it around to people that I knew, like Top Shelf and other companies like that. And it was the kind of thing that everybody liked the idea of straight away, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm just a good salesman, I don't know. But anyway, everyone digged it straight away. And so it was that kind of thing, like, wow, it's got momentum right from the beginning. And, yeah, so I worked out with Top Shelf because I respect them as a publisher, and I've met them several times before in Britain and America. And it worked out exactly as we hoped, because people reacted to it just as we wanted to do. Like, let me see. Let me read a wee bit out to you from
sure. What
the critics said. This is Deborah Olkey, who's a Japanese-American, actually. Although she can't speak Japanese. Can you, Deborah? No, okay, never mind. She said, Axe goes out on a limb where most manga creators dare not go, with an undeniable energy that crackles from almost every page. It will blow your mind. So we had lots and lots of critics react to it in that way, that this was the kind of independent, unusual style manga that people have been waiting for. And that's great to see that. That really was that really pleased us. And it sold a lot of copies too.
And for people maybe who maybe don't read a lot of manga or a lot of alternative manga, like, what kind of stories are we talking about? What kind of you know, style and themes are kind of dealt with?
We're talking about weird shit. Well, it's all types of things. Axe itself, volume one, because we're planning to do more volumes. Volume one has 33 different creators in it, so I mean, it's a very thick collection, coming up for 400 pages, and it's all types of stuff. But I suppose if we were to classify it into three or four different varieties, then one of them is the kind of what's called it's a kind of style from developed in the late 70s. Called Heta Uma, that's the Japanese, which means kind of good, bad, or bad, deliberately bad, but good, Heta Uma. And that is a kind of punk style where the artwork is really very childish looking and primitive, but deliberately so, like a kind of a punk band ethos from the late 70s. So it's got that style in it, and that's one of the strands which is in Axe. Then the other style, which we might say is what's called gekiga. That's like a version manga, gekiga, and that is a kind of style that developed in the late 50s by Tatsumi, Yoshihiro Tatsumi, and Masahiko Matsumoto, and a few other chaps like that in the late 50s in Japan. And the emphasis on that is the more dramatic and personal types of stories that will appeal to adults, mature style stories. There's also a strand in Axe of kind of like toilet humor and sexual humor type stuff, which some people didn't take very kindly to. Can mention that in a minute if you like.
Yes.
And then there's autobiographical type stories, which would fit into a kind of independent American or European style.
Right.
And there's just plain weird, strange stuff in it, which doesn't fit any category. There's the art style ranges from, as I said, with the Heta Uma stuff, very scratchy, basic stuff that looked like they just picked up a pen for the first time that day, to artwork which is extremely sophisticated and very well wrought, well rendered. There's some elements that betray a kind of art European, avant-garde comic book influence. There's all types of stuff.
Right, okay.
as we said, Axe is open. So the whole point of the Axe anthology in Japan and our English version with Top Shelf is that this is anything goes manga.
And the people you mentioned who didn't take to the kind of, sex and toilet humour kind of things, how did that manifest itself?
I'm not sure I should go into that in detail because they're going to jump down my throat again because they did the first time. I'll just say that certain people in certain countries didn't like it. Didn't like this scatological toilet humour style, or the kind of sexual elements that are in it. And the funny thing about that was it was a total surprise to me, because I think British humour and Irish humour too is pretty much based on telling toilet jokes and sexy jokes. That's one big strand of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's normal for us. And to a certain extent in Japan too. But it appears that in America that some people take offence to that more easily, more quickly. So I didn't realise that, actually. I was surprised at that.
Right.
But anyway, the basic, it's up to them. It's what they can react however they wish, of course.
Yep.
But the basic point is that if the book is going to be independent and open and experimental, we can't just say it's going to be open for this thing, but not for that thing.
Mm.
That's not open, right?
Yeah.
So either it's going to have an open policy or it's not, right? So if it is going to have an open policy, then of course there's going to be some things that some people find offensive. But it's worth that to have at least one book out there that has that wide variety of choice, where the artists can do what they really want to do.
Absolutely.
I think that's a valuable thing worth having.
Absolutely. If we could talk a minute about the actual writing process, because I'm always fascinated from, especially with comics, of how the writer goes about the script, how he works with the artist on the piece. Tell us a bit about the way you work.
Well, you know, the funny thing about comic book writing is that, well, there's a whole bunch of funny things about it, but the first thing is that people think it's easy. You know, most people, even in Japan, don't really know how comic books are made. In fact, some people have the kind of crazy idea that the artist just does the whole thing.
Mm.
And then the writer just comes in and fills in the words after the whole thing's finished. Right? I know, actually, I mean, I think in some ways the Marvel way of doing things is not a million miles away from that, but it's a kind of a weird thing. How could that happen? The artist would just do the whole thing and you just fill in the dialogue right at the end. But some people think that's how comics are made. So I have to explain to them that, well, actually, the writer's slightly more important than that. Depending on what kind of writer you are and what kind of relationship you have with your artists, it could be that most of the visual things that you see come from the artist's imagination in the first place. Again, that depends how you do it. If you're going to write it just as a kind of plot-based thing, where you write out like a page full of prose and leave it to the artist to work it out into panels, then in that case, it would be largely the artist who had thought of what the visuals look like. But even in that case, most writers would likely describe some element of the visual of the visual aspects that you see on the page.
Mm.
In my case, I write a kind of panel specific script or a full script in which I break it down into panels. Of course, like 4, 5, 6 panels is normal, depending on which country you're talking about. But if we set up like a 5 or 6 panel page, I normally break it down into what's going to happen in each panel. And where the characters would be and what kind of expressions they're going to have on their faces, and where there might be some kind of double spread that will go from one page A to page B, or etc., etc. I normally put in a moderate amount of visual description to the artist. I think that's specifically the word moderate in my case, because if you describe it in too much detail, the artist gets a wee bit annoyed often and thinks that you're not leaving any room for their ideas.
Yeah.
And after all, they should most of the time have better visual ideas than you as a writer. Not necessarily, but you certainly need to leave room, because it's a collaborative process. It's not a dictatorial one. Mm. Although I think in truth, most of the time, or a lot of the time, I think artists feel that the writer has a slight superiority over them. Maybe superiority is the wrong word, but that if there's some dubiety, as my grandfather used to say, about some way to do something, then normally, in my experience, the artist will bow to the writer's point of view, thinking that they're maybe writer slightly closer to the essence of the story than the artist is. Mm. But of course, for the vast element of it, it's a collaborative process, absolutely. In my book Yakuza Moon with Kodansha, because so many people asked about this, I mean people in Japan, and when I go back home, people ask sometimes, what do you do? What's the process of creating comic? So we decided to put this little four-page bit at the back of Yakuza Moon as to the elements that go on there.
Oh, okay.
So we've got this bit on page 188, and look at it now. It says, write in a manga or comic script. And it's got three pages of text about me describing the process. And then on page four, it's got Michiro. The artist in this case is Michiru Morikawa. And she has drawn a one-page description of her visual process. And she says, and let me just quickly read that out to you, please.
Yes, sir.
Says, when I create my own story, I usually start from this step. Step one is planning the panel layout. I don't write the script first, but use panels and balloons to visually write my story. For Yakuza Moon, I read Sean's script first, then I dived into visualizing the action. And then she goes through the next stage, of course, sketching, stage two, stage three, inking, stage four, toning it, stage five is lettering, and then it's finished.
Yakuza Moon, tell us a bit about it.
Yakuza Moon is based on a true story of a lady called Shoko Tendo. Tendo is her family name. Shoko is her first name. And she has a lady who is well known in Japan, and she has tattoos over almost all of her body apart from her face. And if you look at the cover of Yakuza Moon, it's got a beautiful drawing by Morikawa-san of Tendo-san's back, which is based on a photograph, and she has a beautiful like a Japanese traditional tattoo on her back. And the story of Yakuza Moon starts from when she is a little girl, and she's the daughter of a Yakuza in Osaka, which is a big city in the middle of Japan. And This is called Yakuza Moon, but it's not actually the story of Yakuza. There's not kind of fighting it and people chopping their fingers off left, right, and centre. although there's one bit where the guy does chop his finger off, but this is a true story. But it's about how she copes with it, being a daughter of a Yakuza, and the kind of very bad problems which happen to her. Drug addiction. She kind of gets hooked on having Yakuza boyfriends. She becomes a chimpira herself. Chimpira means like a kind of young thug or Yankee. they call it in Japan. It's like the young teenage thugs that might later become Yakuza, maybe.
Right.
So she becomes that and gets onto various types of drugs and gets hooked and has wild, crazy sex with the older Yakuza bosses in love hotels. Have you heard of love hotels?
Yes, yeah.
It's a big thing in Japan. And people go there to make love, of course. So she gets trapped in a cycle of drug abuse and violent abuse and the degradation of various psychological types. And she's in juvenile jail and all the rest of it. So very, very bad stuff. It's actually extremely horrible stuff that she went through. And this is based on her true life. But in the end, she does manage to like get to a more kind of positive situation. And the tattoo is symbolic of that change where she manages to kind of transform herself. Like she transforms her body and it's symbolic of the way she's transforming her mind too and her lifestyle.
Right.
So that's what it's about.
Okay. How does doing a story like that differ from... You've done like a lot of work for classical comics.
Sure.
How does it differ from, you know, working on a text, an already very established text in a lot of cases?
Well, the process of adaptation is, in a way, quite similar, regardless of that. Like the historical element doesn't really affect it very much. What affects it is more like what is the aim of the adaptation? Because you can have an adaptation which aims to... if you remember the Planet of the Apes, the first Planet of the Apes that came out a few years ago, I mean the first remake, I should say, they didn't call it a remake, they called it a reimagining. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm.
And so, in a way, if you want to make an adaptation which is a reimagining, it means you're actually coming up with a version which is quite different from the original. So there's that way to do it. Or... you want to make a version which is authentic to the original. That's the two key questions, actually. Not so much what the nature of the story is, but what is the aim of this particular version that you're doing? And most of my adaptations have been authentic to the original, where we've tried to keep it as close to the essence of the original as possible, but a visual version. So the stuff I've done with classical comics is Wuthering Heights and A Christmas Carol and A Canterville Ghost by Oscar Wilde. And the next one is Sweeney Todd, the story, you know, the London barber.
Yeah, absolutely. I should say Declan Shalvey is a very good friend of the show.
Oh, he's a good man and he's a good artist. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. It's going to be finished very soon, February. So, I haven't actually seen the art stage myself with that. I've kind of kept back after I've finished the script, but I'm really looking forward to seeing what your man's come up with.
Yeah. The story of Lee.
Well, the story of Lee is, these three books is in a way a kind of good spread of what I've been doing over the last couple of years, because Axe is me being the editor and the kind of center of the action kind of thing from putting this book out. Yakuza Moon is me as an adapter. And then The Story of Lee is my original story from my wee brain, as I keep saying. That's becoming my catchphrase, from my wee brain. it's come out of my experience of Japan and also Hong Kong, where I've been several times. And I wanted to do, first of all, something which was, and contrary to Axe, which is very, as we said, very artistic and experimental, I wanted to try something that was very mainstream, partly just to see if I could. Because the weird thing is that I've put out, I've had 11 books published so far that I've written myself, and about another 10 in anthologies, but none of them have been really mainstream stories so far. So I thought, well, I should have a bash at a mainstream, like, well-worn genre-type story.
Mm.
And so in a way, in a funny kind of way, the story of Lee is like the alternative to my alternatives, if you like. So it's basically a romance story, a cross-cultural romance story, which is a pretty well-worn-out, cliched subject, actually. There's been a million stories like that before. But
how do you go about approaching it from a different angle when it's so well worn?
Well, that's the thing. Maybe I was being a bit stupid, like trying that. But I thought I would deliberately try something that was already very well worn, and see if I could make it still a wee bit vital, despite that. And I think that we've managed to do that. I should say we again, because it's a collaborative process. The artist in this case is Chia Kutsuwada, who's Japanese also, but lives in Britain in this case. So we've done it, I think, by, first of all, not drawing out the resolution of the conflict in some horrible way that takes the whole flame and story. I'm trying not to swear here. Can I swear?
You can swear as much as you like. We fucking love swearing here.
Polite. Did you see that? I was going to say, drawing it over the whole fucking story and I changed it to flame. What a gentleman I am. Actually, there's a scene in the story of Lee where the Gaijin boyfriend, the Western boyfriend, Matt, swears. And I just come across the page by accident. I've got it in my hand. Right. She's saying, he's talking about anti-capitalist stuff. It's very connected to the Occupy movements going on there. He's saying, she says Hong Kong is not a good place for such ideas, anti-capitalism. I think it's one of the most free systems in the world. And the male character replies, yeah, free for capitalists to do whatever they want and pay bugger all taxes. Right? And she replies, please don't swear. Remember, I don't like it. And he says, bugger is not swearing. Well, not much. It's full of, I think, for instance, you don't often get characters in romance things talking about capitalism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's a good example of how we've made it a bit more unusual. But what I was going to say was that most of these kind of romance stories, you can tell after about 10 minutes what the solution of the problem is going to be, right? But they don't get around to the solution until like 2 hours later in the bloody film, right? And I thought this kind of drawn out artificiality in romance films was really annoying, you know? Because you can think, you've got this girl and that girl and that guy, if they just sat down and had a chat for 10 minutes, the thing would be over. The problem would be finished. But in Hollywood movies, they drag it on and on and on, right? And I was getting really tired of that. So I thought, well, I'll deliberately make the conflict in this situation worked out by a few direct conversations where they just face each other and say, this, okay, right? And I was quite glad to do it in that way and a couple of other easy things. But then, of course, various reviewers didn't seem to quite get that. They seemed to not understand that it was a deliberate choice of mine to make it that way. So various reviewers have said, this is a well-told tale and very charming. However, the resolution was too simple and felt, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I think even some of them said it felt artificial, you know, which is a weird thing because the way I've resolved the conflict is far closer to reality.
Yeah.
What they meant was it doesn't fit into their conceptions of the 1,000 films from Hollywood they've seen, which the resolution is drawn out until the last kind of 90%, last 10% of the film, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's really weird. It's really weird, the blending of our experiences watching films and how much that seeps into real life.
This is the thing. But I noticed that myself from the reactions of various reviewers that they were fitting into a mold of stories which they had read in various other manga or comic books or novels or films. And they saw this one didn't fit that mold. And it never occurred to any of them that I might have actually noticed that and deliberately gone against it. But anyway, or maybe some of them did. I'm just trying to. I'm less clever than I think I am. But there you go.
Tell me about this this Iraq comic you worked on. This was kind of well, what was it actually? I'm not really sure.
I like the way you said that. That's very honest.
Yeah. I haven't seen it.
Iraq was a book I did with Lee O'Connor, who sounds very Irish, but he's actually from the countryside in Devon, I think.
All right.
Maybe his dad was Irish, I don't know. And he's a very, very good artist. And we did a book together. This is actually 4 years ago now, but it's typical of another strand of stuff which I do, which is the kind of documentary or social issues type comic books. And it was about what happened in Iraq after the war, when the big companies from America and Britain and Holland and stuff went in, like Bechtel, and had these, you know, $1 billion contracts to clean up this and build this and make the rest of it, you know, rebuild the infrastructure of Iraq. So we did this story about how they basically made a shit job of it, one way or another, you know, in an abusive way. So, and we published it with War on Want, who are a very good, like, activist charity based in London. And that's exactly one key strand of things that I want to do, and which I'm getting more and more into. Comic books which are not published by comic book companies as such, and not on superheroes or fantasy or manga, but are on political, historical, social, psychological themes. So it's using comic books as a medium to put over these complicated issues in an accessible way. And I think it looks like I'm going to be doing a whole lot more of that type of thing, because I've just finished a 200-page script for a New York publisher called Seven Stories, and that is about Michael Albert, who's a well-known economist of the anarchist type. Not anarchist as in smashing things up, of course, but the actual theory, 19th century theory of anarchism. And he's come up with a variety of that called participatory economics, or PARECON for short. And then so we've made a 200-page graphic novel. I just finished the script a couple of weeks ago. And we're calling it PARECOMIC, as a bit of a joke. His theory's PARECON, right, C-O-N.
Yeah.
When we were thinking of titles, it just popped into my head, why don't we call it PARECOMIC? I was just having a laugh, but the title stuck, so it's called that now, PARECOMIC. And that'll be coming out next year. And the subject of that is this visual version of what an alternative to capitalism might be.
Yeah.
Going right back to Michael's days as a MIT radical student in the late 60s. And so I've been very lucky to work with him. And then the same publisher is going to put out another book on the popular history of protest from the early 19th century, which is a book, an idea that I had earlier this year. And then, of course, now in the last couple of months, that's become extremely contemporary with the Occupy movements bursting up all over the place.
Absolutely. Are there many? Is that taking place over in Japan?
I was told a few days ago that there was one in Tokyo.
Okay.
But unfortunately, Japanese people are very, very apolitical. Most people have very little knowledge about things like alternatives to capitalism or socialism or communism or anything like that at all. Most people know very little about it, unfortunately. Huh. But there was something in Tokyo, I've heard, so maybe that's increasing here too, hopefully.
Yep. And do you think will the book lead right up to present day, or?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it's a weird thing how these things happen sometimes. I mean, I had that idea. The beginning of the idea was from my dear friend Winston Churchill, a friend of the Irish everywhere. He wasn't, but anyway, let's not go down that road. He wrote this book in the 1930s and 40s and 50s called A History of the English Speaking Peoples, right?
Okay.
And then one of the criticisms of his book was that he went on about war too much and great statesmen and all the rest of it. And so when I was reading that, I thought it'd be a good idea to do one about popular protests, you know, like ordinary people's history. So then the title came to me. Well, we could change Churchill's title to A Visual History of Protests Amongst the English-Speaking Peoples.
Okay.
And I thought, that's that. I was having a laugh again, but I thought, wait a minute, that's a good idea. And then, so that was the beginning of this year. And so it's a bit of a long-winded title, so we're actually calling the main title, oh, I shouldn't really be saying this before it's published, actually.
All right, you're not going to give us the exclusive.
No, our publishers don't like you say anything. They get pissed off. Anyway, that's the subtitle. I won't tell you what the full title is because they're happy. But anyway, so it's going to be a 150-page book about history of popular protests going right. The first one will be like the Luddites. From the early 19th century and how they protested against various elements from that early capitalist era, industrialised Britain, of course, and right up to the present Occupy movements. So we're going to include that in it. And I just sent an email this week to the Occupy New York people to try and get their active involvement in this book. So it's going to be very contemporary.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Well, the whole point of it was to say that popular protest now and stuff from the past is all connected. It's not some thing that doesn't matter now, you know? Mm. I mean, I think Irish people are aware of this a lot more than other people because, of course, the various protests in Ireland, there's a kind of awareness of the history of how these developed from the early, like, Fenian movements, et cetera, you know?
Yeah.
Right back to the late 18th century. But I think most people in other countries don't have such a strong sense of the history of it. But so we wanted to try and say that all these things are connected, and the protests that you might go on today in New York or tomorrow in London or next Thursday in Madrid or whatever, they're all connected. So it's a really odd thing that this popular protest has really just exploded up again in the last couple of months, you know, exactly as what I was thinking about with the book. It's a weird coincidence.
Sean, it's been great talking to you.
And I've just been talking to you. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's been great. It's been fascinating to listen to because my knowledge of comics from Japan, I mean, probably only stems to Tatsumi and a few other books like that. But I am now about to go to Amazon to get a whole load more.
Good man. Well, of course, Tatsumi's. I was going to say he's one of my lads, but no, he's not. Sorry, Tatsumi. Joe Dandy's. He's in the next book as well, and he has kindly agreed to write the introduction to our next book, which is from Top Shelf, which is Cigarette Girl by Masahiko Matsumoto.
Oh, brilliant.
And Matsumoto is Tatsumi's colleague from right back to 56, I think we first met, 1956. And this will be another big step forward in that kind of mature, as I said, Gekiga style manga, which is available. Because it was Tatsumi and Matsumoto who really are the key guys that came up with that at that time, 56, 57, 58. And so his first book in English will come out next year from Top Shelf. We just finished the main bits of it over the last couple of weeks. And it's been a privilege for me, of course, to meet Tatsumi and chat to him about in Tokyo, to chat to him about those early days That's been one of the most exciting things for me, being here in Japan, to get this chat with him and meet him directly. It's nice.
It must be strange for him to have his books, you know, from the 60s onwards published over here. It must be such a strange thing for them to come out.
Yeah, but he's, I think he's kind of quite, he appears to be quite relaxed about it, but, you know, a lot of Japanese men, they don't show the emotions so directly anyway. That's a normal thing here, but it's quite a while now that these things have been out, and they've been out in French and Italian and Spanish and other countries too, so he's quite used to it now, but he's very pleased as far as I can see.
Yeah.
He's pleased with this somewhat late attention, and in the case of Matsumoto, too late, because Matsumoto died 5 years ago or 6 years ago. But still, at least we can bring these books out, and now we get Matsumoto some well-deserved attention too. But the latest thing with Tatsumi, I'm not sure if you knew this, but a guy which I know, I've come to know, Eric Koo in Singapore, has made an animation based on Tatsumi's stories.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, a wonderful animation. And he was in London recently, and I hooked him up with Paul Gravett. they're going to, I think there's various plans to do things in Britain and in English. But anyway, it already won an award at the Cannes Film Festival this year. And it's a wonderful animation, very true to Tatsumi's original stories. As I said, this is like my kind of adaptation style, an authentic adaptation style that Eric has made. And Tatsumi's voice is in the animation too. So that's the latest good thing to come out from Tatsumi's manga. But Tatsumi's not finished yet. I mean, he's still making stuff now. So he's still going to come up with some more good stuff.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's like anything for, you know, following any authors like Murakami or anyone from Japan, there's always this horrible delay for it to be translated.
Mm-hmm. There's not much we can do about that, because these things take time, you know. It took us 2 years from that New York meeting to get Axe out, almost exactly. And a lot of work. And it's taken us about a year and a half to get the Matsumoto book together, but now that's ready. So, please check that out. Cigarette Girl from Matsumoto will be coming out soon. But before then, yeah, please buy one or all of my books. Axe, The Story of Lee, or Yakuza Moon. It's a bit late for the Iraq one, I think, but never mind.
Well, Sean Michael, it's been brilliant talking to you. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Liam. Take care now.